For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. So Oklahoma had an election this past Tuesday. Oh, man, there were so many shockers to come out of Wednesday morning, but the biggest has got to be legalization of medical marijuana in the state. Ryan, did this surprise you?
You know, I think that, you know, walking into this election, we knew that momentum was behind this ballot question. You know, the polling, early polling suggested that it had enough numbers to withstand even a big negative attack that it saw, you know, $500,000 at least in an ad buy purchased. And you couldn't turn on the TV in Oklahoma without the state chamber of commerce and their buddies coming on TV trying to scare everyone about medical marijuana and what it might be. And I think voters saw through that for the most part, and the numbers bore that out. You know, it didn't get over 60%, which is where some of the numbers had initially had it way back in February. But you know, 55% thereabouts. That's a strong showing for that. And if you look at the counties where it passed, this wasn't a referendum that passed just in Oklahoma and Tulsa County. There are a lot of rural counties where this got over 50%, and even the ones where it didn't, it was really close. There's a lot of strong support for this. A lot of unanswered questions right now. The Health Department, you know, God bless the bureaucrats in Oklahoma. They have come up with draft rules. They had them out even before the ballot question was approved by the people of Oklahoma. There's some question now as to whether or not the governor is going to call a special session. If she does call a special session, there are a few different variables there. The legislature could punt this indefinitely. I think that that's a terrible call. They could extend the period for regulatory rulemaking, which could be like 120 days. I think that would be responsible. Or they could do nothing. The legislature and the governor could say, we're going to let the health department rules roll, in which case there's going to be an expedited process that'll just follow the law. There's going to be a public hearing on July 10th, and we can start to see applications, things could start rolling out in the fall. It's really exciting. This is an incredibly historic and important step towards a more sensible drug policy in the state of Oklahoma.
Neva,
well, I think when you look at the turnout, I mean, I think that's the first big takeaway. 880,000 Oklahomans coming out, and you're right. I think 57% may be the final number on the state question, or close to it. And I mean, it is clear that the voters spoke, and I think what we're hearing even lawmakers say in the aftermath, as well as the governor, is that there's certainly no intent to take away the will of the people. I mean, I think the need for the regulatory framework and how that comes about is the big question, and hopefully there will be an orderly process for that to occur. But now we are one of, I think, 29 states at a place where they have legalized medical marijuana in this instance. So it was a fascinating, I think, look at Oklahoma in from a voter standpoint of what will propel them to the polls. And clearly, in a year when we had the governor's race, all secondary races, congressional contested races on both Republican and Democrat sides, as well as probably the largest lineup of legislative races that were contested, up to as many as 12 in one primary on the Republican side, it really was interesting to see what would really motivate people in a climate where there was as much negativity on the airwaves as there were good just strong basic debates between a myriad of issues. It really kind of honed in on one or two things rather than what we normally see in a regular political cycle.
More people turned out in this primary election than the 2014 general election. So, I mean, that's a huge turnout, and I think a lot of that were first-time voters, or voters that maybe had voted, you know, a couple of years ago, and they just decided they wanted to show up for this ballot question. It'll be interesting to see, you know, whether that turnout holds up in future elections, both in the runoff and then especially in the general election. I would encourage those voters. The legislators are going to have a big role in how this is implemented, and so it's important that your voice, if you wanted medical marijuana in the state of Oklahoma, show up at that runoff election, show up in that general election, make sure your voice is out there, because if not, they'll start to take that for granted, and some of the things that you see change may not be what you want. You need to be able to have input and hold these folks accountable.
And I think you talked about the early voting or the fact that that was significant. When you look at the fact that in Tulsa, early voting was up 6%, but in Oklahoma County, it was up 16%. I mean, those are significant numbers because they exceed the presidential preference primary 2 years ago. So I think we are seeing, we talk about that we've had voter apathy and we've had, you know, really an electorate that's not been very good about coming out to a lot of these elections. But in this instance, for this primary, you're right, Ryan. I mean, we saw a good turnout. Will it continue, and will that be true not only in the runoffs late August, but what will we see in November as right. well?
One election does not a trend make, I guess we can say. But I do want to ask about there was a mention of some people not getting the medical marijuana ballots. It didn't seem like it was that big. It seemed like it was more media hype, but. Could that concern as far as any kind of a legal challenge?
Yeah, I don't think that you will see any legal challenges. You know, the ACLU of Oklahoma, we run voter protection hotlines almost on every election. We received a number of complaints. We were very insistent that if you're calling in, it needs to have happened to you or you need to have directly witnessed it. Right. It's not enough to call in and say, this happened to my friend or I saw this on Facebook.
This we
heard about this. And every time that we would get somebody that it either happened to them or they witnessed something, we'd call the county election board. We'd visit with folks, had a long, wonderful conversation with the election board secretary in Tulsa County. And I'm sure that at some of these precincts, we're talking about volunteers, people that are not paid a whole lot of money, that mistakes were made. Whether there was ill intent behind that or not, you know, we don't know. But I'm sure that there were probably some mistakes that were made. But
do you think that will swing?
I don't think it would swing it. And so when we looked into it, it's probably where it happened maybe, you know, a handful of times. And then that was extrapolated on social media. So it looked like it was happening a lot more than it actually was. If that were happening in a widespread or in some sort of conspiratorial format, what we would see is a huge number of undervotes on 788 ballots versus the partisan ballots that were cast in those precincts.
Right.
We haven't seen that yet. And I doubt that actually comes to fruition. Right.
Well, the Republican race for governor is heading to a runoff. While this isn't a surprise to anyone, the news the runoff is going forward without Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb is pretty big. Neva, what do you think of the race now down to former Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett and Tulsa businessman Kevin Stitt?
I think it'll be a fascinating race. I mean, when you look at kind of the way these two folks wound up in the runoff, I mean, Cornett carried 23 counties, Stitt carried 13, which means that Todd Lamb actually carried more counties, 40 counties, I believe it was, Ted, Fisher, you know, had one county won in the southeastern part of the state. But yeah, I mean, what we had was the metropolitan areas, I mean, very decisively coming in. I mean, you had the Oklahoma County area where Mick Cornett dominated 45% of the vote against basically Stitt and Lamb with 20% each. And then conversely on the Tulsa side, you had Stitt dominating with 33%, and then you had both Cornett and Lamb in the low 20s. So, I mean, those two guys kind of had their geographic base that they were really kind of launching off of, it would appear. And then, you know, Todd Lamb, well-known across Republican Party circles and traditional primary voting circles statewide and certainly in the rural areas, I think with this uptick in turnout, with perhaps many people that the interesting thing to see in the post-election analysis will be how many first-time voters were there, how many, you know, what we call one and two voters, folks that rarely go out during a primary but might occasionally go out in a presidential contest maybe every 4 or 8 years. I mean, those folks, did they come out? Were they being driven by the state question? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, how did that really impact these primaries? Yeah. I mean, that's one of the interesting takeaways that I think will be analyzed for some time to come.
Ryan, you called it actually a couple weeks ago, how surprising it would be if Todd Lamb was not in. So how surprising is it that Todd Lamb's not
there? I think
that
we saw the indications of that in some of the late polls that showed it a much closer race than a lot of folks anticipated. There was always the sense for the longest trajectory of this primary that Lamb was going to be in first, and it was going to be a fight between Cornett and Stitt to be in that second place. And you began to see numbers from Lamb trend down. And there was also this sense that we saw from his campaign where he was kind of flailing about. He never really had a sense of who he was, what he was as a candidate. You know, he on one hand tried to be an outsider, and then the other hand he tried to be the consummate insider who, you know, could keep the wheels on government if he were elected and ready to go on day one. And this identity crisis within his campaign, combined with the sinking poll numbers and the rise of Stitt and Cornette, I think you really made it difficult for Lamb to walk out of Election Day, even in that number two spot. It was incredibly close. There are a lot of moving pieces moving forward into this runoff, as Neva said. You know, where do Dan Fisher's votes right. go? I think that those probably go to Stitt. He's the decidedly more conservative, more pro-life, social conservative in the race now. Where do Lamb's votes go? I think that that's a more mixed question. And then on the metropolitan turnout, I think metropolitan turnout was really driven by State Question 788, even in that Republican primary. If that's depressed in the runoff, and the rural areas begin to, you know, continue to show up, because right. those are your more traditional conservative voters that are going to be there on runoff election day, come hell or high water. What's the turnout like? And does that favor Stitt or Cornette? My sense is that probably favors Stitt. I think right. that Cornette's in trouble without the ballot question on that runoff
election.
And
when you look at those top tier counties and where the votes are, I mean, there were some interesting looks at counties like Payne County, for instance, where Cornette actually got more votes than the other two combined. I mean, it dominated there. In Garfield County, home county for Todd Lamb, Todd Lamb basically lost to Cornette by 73 votes. I mean, that was the difference between the two of them. Very competitive. But still, I mean, when you look at those takeaways, I mean, what you saw were Republicans kind of all over the board. And if you go with the trend that everyone seemed to be analyzing in the last 10 days, that it was very fluid, that it could be any combination of the three of them, and you actually then look at the way the undecideds likely were breaking, we see that whether it was the dominating, dominating last-minute push by Stitt on the airwaves, or was it Cornette, who seemed to have more of a systematic, just low-key ground game than either Lamb or Stitt to some degree. So I think that's interesting. Is there some sort of an ability with a ground game out there, and whose ground? And now we are into. Always say this about primaries. Yeah. If we think that's true about primaries in a runoff, where historically the drop off is at least a very significant number, whether it's 20%, 30%, 40%, whatever it is, it's dramatic normally,
right.
And that could be a big factor in this particular election.
And we talked about in the run up to this election that it was a fairly kind. It was not. There was no barbs. There were no jabs at any of your opponents. Do you see that changing
I think it's going to change some.
The interesting thing about that was that Richardson really appeared to go on the attack on Stitt toward the end, very aggressively, which was something I think somewhat unexpected. I mean, here was someone kind of driving up his own negatives, trying to drag down another candidate, which in a multi-way primary it doesn't seem to be a good strategy in most instances. So I thought, you know, whether that played in the Tulsa, the Tulsa equation in particular, where they both are from, I don't know. But I thought it was interesting to see that come into the mix.
And Todd Lamb may not be on that runoff ballot, but he's going to have a lot of influence.
Absolutely.
And I think if Cornette's path to victory is going to rely a lot on capturing those Lamb voters, because those Lamb voters, even though they weren't enough to put Lamb into the runoff, Lamb voters are traditional conservative Republican Party voters. They are there on runoff day, and I think that Lamb was counting on that if he could get into the runoff and get past all of the hype around State Question 788, that he would be a solid favorite in that runoff. But since he's not there, he's going to have a big influence on who ultimately wins that runoff.
I would agree completely with that.
And I also got to ask, because there were a lot of lawmakers who lost the race who had voted against the tax increase for the teacher pay. They, five of them lost in their primary races. They won to more center-right, who would have voted, who supported that. Now, Lamb obviously did not vote for that, but he had come out from the very beginning saying he was opposed to it. Now, the other two might have been opposed to it as well, but he is an actual elected official saying he was opposed to it. Do you think that might have had an effect on his lower turnout as well?
I think that maybe more than that, you know, thinking longer term, that if he'd made it to the general election, I think that, you know, the Edmondson camp, you know, Edmondson sailed to victory as the Democratic nominee for governor. And if Todd Lamb had been the Republican nominee, that would have been charge number one against Todd Lamb in the general election. I don't know how much of that dot was connected. And again, that kind of goes back to Todd Lamb trying to say that he was an insider and he knows how government works, but that also ties him to a lot of the failures that the voters have seen at the legislature, and at the same time trying to brand himself as an outsider.
And he also tried to tie himself to the Trump factor, which, mm-hmm. you know, dominated Donald 2 years ago, 36 points was the margin. So that didn't seem to play. I mean, we had candidates even down ballot that were in legislative races running the drain the swamp type strategy and messaging, and didn't seem to play well with the voters. It didn't take away from what they feel about the numbers and popularity of the president when you see the poll numbers, but it didn't seem to connect that was just an automatic, you're going to transfer that goodwill, that favorability at the top on down to a lower ballot race.
And speaking of on the top, how much, I mean, Governor Fallon is not a very popular governor right now. How much does that
She was absent him? From the process and absent from this election cycle.
I think that'll continue to be the case. I think that she's not going to inject herself, and I think it would be a mistake, frankly, for any of these candidates to try to reach out to her and get her support. I think that regardless of how her actual tenure is going to be judged by history, right. you know, this current political moment, even in the Republican primary, doesn't lend itself to somebody saying, I want Mary Fallon on my team.
That's right.
The GOP race for attorney general was already contentious between incumbent Mike Hunter and challenger Gentner Drummond. Now we get to see more of the same for two more months as the two are heading to a runoff election on August 28th. Ryan, should Hunter be concerned about a runoff with Drummond?
I think that this is what happens whenever you're the incumbent, but you don't have the power of the incumbency. He was appointed to this position. Mm-hmm. He wasn't elected to this position. And so the primary, if he were going to have any advantage whatsoever as an incumbent, it was going to be in that primary, and he needed to do it without getting into a runoff. Now it's a runoff. It's anybody's game. The margins are close enough that I think that, you know, again, depending on what that turnout model looks like, Drummond could beat him. And it's going to be, if we thought that we'd seen negative ads running up into the primary, and frankly, I think that a lot of folks were surprised that it ended up in a runoff, that either of these two candidates wasn't able to eke past 50%. And so, you know, we're at this spot now where it's winner take all death match in the cage. Yeah. You know, two men enter, one comes away, and
the
Thunderdome. it's AG Thunderdome.
And Angela Bonilla turned out to be probably a little bit of a spoiler. They might have, a lot of people said, well, I'm not going to vote for either. I'll vote for this.
That's
third
exactly,
person.
Yeah.
I think there was some of that, but I think when you look at the numbers, I mean, Mike Hunter carried 61 counties. I mean, he was dominant in the Oklahoma County metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. Drummond did not prove to be as dominant in Tulsa by any stretch, only a 4-point swing there. So I think we have a setup where, again, if we talk about who are the likely people to come out in a runoff and getting back to more traditional base voters, get past the kind of the shrillness and the negativity of the first round, I don't think that can be sustained in round two. I think that kind of has all been out there and really kind of beat to death, and I think the voters are not going to want to be just inundated with that type of messaging in the second round. And I think it will now begin to be more of a race of contrast and really a look between the two candidates to see how they measure up. I think the late debate right before the primary seemed to garner some real attention because you had all three candidates. They were seated and they were given some very serious questions and really in a more, what I would consider more of a not true debate format, but at least a format where if a voter was really interested in hearing these folks and what they have to say and where their points of view are really landed, it was that opportunity. And frankly, I think the voters would welcome the opportunity to see more of that in the next 2 months in this runoff, so that they could really begin to know these candidates better. Because you're exactly right, Ryan. I mean, when you're not a household name, when you haven't been on the ballot multiple times, and you're out swinging, I mean, and you have three people in a race, it's not surprising that someone is not going to, you know, crack 50% plus one if it's a very competitive spending race and a very competitive just race overall. Well, and that's what we had in this one.
So many times I've seen the runoff go and the second place person in the primary ends up winning. That happens on a regular basis. So
there's a number that, and I can't recall it off the top of my head, that Professor Keith Gaddy at the University of Oklahoma referred. And if the
35%, I think, is his number. You know,
if it's below that, then the leader
is basically a reset.
Yeah, then it's a reset. And so, and I think that that's where we're at right now. It'll be, I think that neither of the, I don't think, I'd be interested to know whether the internal polling from the Drummond or the Hunter camp foresaw a runoff. Because if they didn't think that there was going to be a runoff and they spent all of their ammunition on the negatives, or is there something that Hunter or Drummond has up their sleeve? And if there's not something new, I tend to agree with Neva, because if there's not something new, I think Angela Bonilla ran a solid campaign. You know, she earned a lot of her votes, but I think some of them did go to her because folks were tired of what they were seeing out of Drummond and Hunter.
I don't want to spend too long on this, but just any other thoughts on any other elections that kind of grabbed your attention?
District attorney race in Tulsa County. Right. Steve Kunstweiler, the incumbent there, is in a runoff with Ben Fu, a former assistant district attorney. Ben Fu and Tammy Westcott both challenged Steve Kunstweiler from a reform perspective, from a criminal justice reform perspective. And if you put the two of those votes together, they got more votes than the incumbent did. And I think that what that says is that voters, even in a Republican primary, even in the party that is most organically attuned to a law and order, tough on crime message, that even there, criminal justice reform is a resonant issue and is going to be a powerful one, even if it's not this election cycle, even if Fu decides to run to the right, or however that works, however this race plays out. Moving forward, future DA candidates, I think, would be wise to embrace criminal justice reform. Yeah.
I think it's fascinating that we have as many runoffs as we do shaping up. I mean, we've got 34. Yeah. I mean, we have 5 congressional districts all with a runoff. Mm-hmm. We have 7 of the statewide races headed to runoffs.
Including Joy Hoffmeister.
That's right. I mean, and so I think it's going to be something very fascinating, particularly for Republicans who had campaigns up and down the ballot, but that we had these instances where no one could break through, even in small fields. I mean, it wasn't that you had 5 or 6 or something that predictably you knew was going to round two. You had three people in some of those races, and it didn't square up to where anyone could punch it through. So I think the fact that we are going to have as many runoffs could dictate some real interesting results at the top of the ticket, as much as it will for just these individual, particularly legislative races, where historically they would be struggling to get voters out, mm-hmm. period, and now they're going to be aided by the fact that a lot of money and effort's going to be spent in these statewide races, and that benefits them if they can figure out a game plan to capitalize on it.
Long-term incumbent like Mike Ritz in a runoff, I mean, I think everybody cancel your summer vacation plans because between the potential special session, and even if there's not a special session, just paying attention to the implementation of medical marijuana, the runoffs coming up in August,
November anticlimactic.
It really might. I think that it's not beyond.
It's still a Republican state numerically.
Yeah. Right. So. It's not beyond the pale that the primary turnout could exceed the general election turnout later in November. Yeah.
Finally, we absolutely have to talk about one bit of non-election news to drop over the past week. Last Friday, the state Supreme Court killed a petition referendum by the group sponsored by former Senator Tom Coburn. The attempt to kill the tax increases for pay raises to teachers, school support staff, and state workers by Oklahoma Taxpayers Unite was declared invalid. Ryan, is this battle over?
I think it's over for now. I think that it could reset during the next legislative session, and depending on the new faces that we see coming in. But the trend from this election cycle is that voters preferred candidates that were supportive of revenue-raising measures to invest in education and other core state services. So I don't think we'll see that again. I think that this was the right call by the state Supreme Court. They called it on multiple issues. They essentially said in their opinion, any one of these defects would be enough to invalidate the referendum. But
there were several.
The lack of the inclusion of certain taxes, the hotel tax, the little cigar tax, and the failure to attach an exact copy of the bill that they are seeking to either put in front of the voters to approve or reject, and the confusing way in which they worded the language. I mean, I think all of those things combined, the court didn't have a lot of options. There was that one of the dissents said, you know, they would have let it go forward, and then after it was circulated, they could rewrite the ballot title. But I think that, you know, frankly, it's not just what the voters are looking at in November, it's what voters are looking at whenever they're signing it.
Sure.
The final piece of this, Inside Baseball, Justice Weyrich, up for confirmation right now before the United States Senate to go on the Western District federal bench in Oklahoma. He has a dissent in that is forthcoming. It hasn't been published yet. So it'll be interesting to see what Justice Weyrich's dissent and what his rationale is there.
Neva.
Well, I think Ryan is right. I mean, I think this is now virtually a moot point. Mm-hmm. I mean, the court basically said, look, there is time to file a new referendum. You can, your deadline's July 18th, but you can't use the signatures that you already have. So you have to go back and get 41,000 new signatures. You know, almost an insurmountable task, even with a massive paid effort, it would be a very daunting challenge. So I think that the sloppiness and all that went on that took it to the court, and then the court having to make the statements and render the opinion that they did, kind of puts a point on this, and now we move forward. It's an issue that's not going to go away, just like we know. I mean, it's the same basic players on both sides of this, both sides of this argument are still going to be out there, and I think trying to inject some of this into the elections, both in the runoffs as well as in the fall. So it's a debate not going away. It's just not going to play out like many that had initiated this petition drive had hoped for.
In 1990, the fight to kill HB 1017 led to State Question 640.
Right.
Are we going to see something like that again?
I think it's actually more likely that we see a ballot question that would amend State Question 640 rather than to double down on what 640 already does, you know, to make it easier for the legislature to approve revenue-raising measures. Mm-hmm. It might not be a simple majority, but, you know, something that makes it easier. Because legislators on both sides of the aisle, I think, were frustrated by the artificial constraints that State Question 640 put on their ability to deal with the budget crisis that they were facing this session.
There you go. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KLSU, its staff, or management.